Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road in beautiful, almost downtown Santa Fe. We can be found on the web at www.ksfr.org. We are talking today to John Potterat. He is an epidemiologist who, for 30 years, was the director of the STD AIDS program at the El Paso County Department of Health and Environment in Colorado. He's the author of numerous articles on sexually transmitted diseases, and he's been recognized by the Centers for Disease Control for his exceptional contributions to STD programs. Welcome, John, to the Radio Cafe.
It's my pleasure.
It's great to have you here. Now, our subject today is a tough one. It's AIDS in Africa. First of all, how widespread is AIDS and HIV infection in Africa, which, of course, is a vast continent? Does it vary a lot from one country to another?
It does, and generally it's the areas in East and South Africa that have the most, the heaviest burden, and as countries of West Africa, much less so. And, of course, North Africa has probably the least amount.
So, in the places where HIV is a problem, how widespread is it inside the population?
The estimates vary, but they're high. They're in the neighborhood of 10 to 25% of the general population has HIV, which is just an absolutely staggering number. It's just difficult to understand. It's a pandemic.
And how does that compare to AIDS infection in, say, the United States or other European countries or other third world countries?
Oh, it's greater by a factor of 20, 30, 40, something like that. It's huge. I think somewhere around 1% of the population in developed countries might have HIV compared to, say, 20% of theirs. And so it's just an enormous burden, and it needs explanation. I mean, why Africa? That's the key question.
Well, that's the question we're going to be talking about today. I think most people in the U.S. believe that AIDS in this country is a disease of gay men and IV drug users, while in Africa it's spread largely through heterosexual transmission. And what's interesting about your work is that you've begun to challenge that assumption. What got you thinking that maybe there was a problem in that way of thinking?
Well, a couple of things. One of them is the magnitude of the epidemic. There just simply isn't enough sex going on in Africa to explain the huge numbers of cases. If Africans were having sex all day long, they couldn't generate that kind of force of infectivity. Because sexually speaking, meaning penis to vagina, it's just too inefficient a mode of transmission. The probability of transmission from penis to vagina is somewhere about in the neighborhood of 1 in 1,000 per exposure. And so it's a reluctant sexually transmitted disease. So something has got to explain why there is such a turbo effect in Africa, and it ain't sex.
Well, hang on a second. When you say 1 in 1,000, let's just explain that a little bit. If a man and a woman have penis to vagina sex, and the man is HIV positive, the chances of her contracting HIV are 1 in 1,000.
Somewhere in that neighborhood, yes. And in the reverse direction, if the woman has HIV, say in the female reproductive tract in the vagina, then the probability of a male picking it up is lower. It's probably 1 in 3,000. Because it's always more difficult for a woman to infect a man than it is for a man to infect a woman. So it's extremely low.
And what about other types of sex, oral sex and anal?
Oral sex, it's rarely transmitted that way. So for all intents and purposes, mouth to penis sex is probably safe, quote unquote, because the risks are so low. Now, the most dangerous is penis to rectum. It's probably in the neighborhood of 1 in 70 or 1 in 100, somewhere in the neighborhood. It's 10 times more efficient than penis to vagina. So that's one of the reasons that gay men have such a high burden. It's not that the virus, recognizes somebody's sexual orientation. They just recognize the opportunity to catapult themselves into the bloodstream, and it's easier to do that way anally than it is vaginally.
So when you look at these numbers, the idea that AIDS is transmitted heterosexually in Africa to get those high numbers basically made you stop and think, hey, wait a minute, maybe there's something going on here.
Yeah, that's the number one thing, and that happened to me about 20 years ago. But in the meanwhile, I was busy doing HIV control in Colorado as a public health officer. In the meanwhile, reading the literature of what was going on in Africa, you began to see a lot of things that just didn't make sense, what I called anomalies, things that just don't add up. And there now, by now, there's about a dozen very serious anomalies that undermine the idea that sex is driving the epidemic in Africa. It looks like something else is driving it, and it's probably needles. Needles are a very efficient means of transmitting blood-borne infections like hepatitis and HIV, much more efficient than sex. And I don't mean needles like injecting drug use. In Africa, there's probably relatively little of that, but I mean contaminated injections in medical settings or in dental settings or in ritualistic settings. People reusing needles for medical, dental, or ritual purposes.
We're talking to epidemiologist John Potterat. What are some of the anomalies that you were just referring to in the literature on AIDS in Africa?
Well, the biggest one that jumps at you is the opposite trajectories that are being traveled by garden variety sexually transmitted diseases like gonorrhea and syphilis and herpes and HIV. In several countries, Zimbabwe for one, South Africa for another, during the 1990s, HIV took off extremely fast and, you know, multiplied at the rate of maybe 12% annual increases at the same time that the standard venereal diseases were declining rapidly. Syphilis in South Africa and all kinds of different STD in Zimbabwe. So, that, you know, if they were both transmitted the same way, penis to vagina, why would you have opposite trajectories?
What do you attribute the decline in other STDs like syphilis? What did you attribute that to?
I think it's because Africans are smart. They've been paying attention to the World Health Organization and UNAIDS messages that you need to, that if you're going to be into sexual activity, you need to suit up for the event, meaning use condoms. And what happens then is that they've been more responsible about their sexual behaviors, and that has indeed taken care of reducing the classically transmitted diseases that are really sexually transmitted, but it hasn't done the job for HIV because it's probably not being sexually transmitted in the degree that they believe. Another thing that's been a tremendous anomaly is that in many fairly well-conducted studies in Africa, in several parts of Africa, Tanzania, Uganda, Zimbabwe, and in South Africa, there's been very little correlation between sexual variables and the prevalence of HIV infection. It just seems these things are not correlated. There's lots of areas where that have high HIV burden that have, and other areas that have low HIV burdens, and you can't correlate the frequency of partner change or taking your partners concurrently or having sex with prostitutes or having venereal disease doesn't correlate with whether you have high or low prevalence. And that's happened time and time again. So that tells you that something is seriously wrong with the view that sex is driving the epidemic. Another one that I'd like to tell you about is prenatal. When women go to get prenatal care, generally, there's very high levels of HIV in these women in certain parts of Africa. 30% is not unusual of these prenatal women having HIV, and which is a higher level of infection than women in the general community who are not prenatal patients and who don't go to prenatal clinics. Why would women who are pregnant have incredible levels of HIV when women in the community have much lower levels? So that's a tip-off that something is really wrong here.
And so what is the answer? Why would they?
Well, we don't know what the answer is because the proper studies haven't been done, but we suspect from the available information, and we've canvassed the medical and scientific literature coming out of Africa, that medical injections and other forms of needles being used in medical or dental circumstances are responsible for probably two-thirds of all the infections in Africa. We estimate based on these data that are published, that maybe a quarter to a third of all infections in Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa, are caused by sex. The other two-thirds, or 75%, are probably caused by needles.
This is something which I think a lot of people don't know and don't think about. We think of HIV and AIDS as sexually transmitted diseases primarily. That's the association that we have in our minds. I wonder, this is something that you and I have talked about before, that there's a stereotype that a lot of Westerners and I think Americans have in their minds, that African people have a different sexual morality or different sexual codes, that they're hypersexual. Have you found that stereotype to influence people's thinking, and have you been able to get any data that goes behind that reality?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely correct. Initially, the reason that they felt it was clearly going to be sexually transmitted in Africa is because they had these ideas that somehow African sexuality was different from that of other people. African sexuality is a bit like fortunes, tends to be overestimated. And it turns out that after they did a series of surveys in a dozen African countries between 1988 and 1993, they found that African sex lives are not terribly different from those of other people like the Danes or the English or the French or the North Americans. They're strikingly similar. So that if indeed these reports correspond to reality, why would Africa drive an epidemic sexually when it's not happening in the developed world outside of, gay circles?
What about the level of gay and bisexual behavior in Africa? Has that been studied?
Yes, well, studied insufficiently, and that's one of the major problems with the science coming out of Africa. It's really not been first-class science. It's been actually pretty shoddy. But, our investigation of the anthropological literature as well as the medical and clinical literature indicates that anal intercourse is not uncommon in Africa. And it's just that the questions aren't being asked or aren't being asked properly, and so that little is known about it. But the most important implication of that is that the sexual messages are not getting out, that penis to rectum sex is very dangerous. So that there are people in Africa who think that if they do penis to rectum sex, it's safe because it doesn't involve regular sex. And the messages have been saying that it's regular sex that causes AIDS.
And so it's exactly the opposite of the truth.
Right, which is the great irony. And part of the problem with the science in Africa is it's not paid much attention to these kinds of things. It's just mentioned heterosexual sex. And what does heterosexual mean? It's much better to have messages that specifically address risk behaviors like penis to vagina, penis to rectum, make it concrete so people understand it. And also to do the proper studies that control for needles. In the last 17 years or so, scientists and researchers in Africa have not asked questions about exposures to needles on the part of patients that have HIV. So how can they know how to transmit it if they're so focused on the sexual paradigm, on the sexual idea, that they ignore asking about other modes of transmission? That would be forgivable if it were for gonorrhea or syphilis, because that's the only way they're transmitted, is penis to something. But with HIV and the hepatitis, it can be transmitted other ways, and they're not looking at these other ways.
Is that specific to Africa, that I guess you would have to call it a grave omission, or is that something that happens all over the third world?
I think it happens all over the third world or developing poor countries, but also I think it happens here. For example, let's take African-American women. They're the ones at highest risk in this country in their so-called heterosexual populations for HIV. Why is it that African-American women have 20 times the risk of their white sisters or of their Hispanic sisters? I have no idea what the real reason is, but when you have such a disparate change, it's a huge difference in risk, I think it's your scientific obligation to go out and do the kind of investigation that explains that rather than relying on the default assumption, well, We all know African American women are freer about sex or some nonsense like that. And it may be the case, I don't know. The point is the science isn't being done. And I think we're derelict in our public health duties when we just note that African American women are such high risk and don't try to find exactly what's going on. My feeling is it's very possible that poor African American women are being exposed to needle exposures either in jail or through tattooing or through acupuncture, I don't know, and maybe getting it that way, because poor people may go to poor medical providers who don't pay much attention to safe dental or health care. We just don't know because we're not asking the questions.
I think the focus on on AIDS as a primarily sexually transmitted disease, when it's not, is basically a paradigm shift that people are going to have to do. But there's another factor in that, which is when you, as an epidemiologist, are studying it, how do you get people to tell the truth about what they've done, about their behavior, sexual or otherwise?
You'd be surprised. People are quite willing to tell you the most intimate secrets of their lives. They're just marvelous if they're approached properly and if they trust you. And it takes a while to develop trust, and sometimes it takes repeated meetings and interviews before, you know, all the truth comes out. Some people are reluctant to say they do this, that, or the other until they know they can trust you and they feel comfortable telling you these things. That's number one. So sometimes it takes repeated questioning. The second and most important part is that there are not technologies that permit you to ask these questions anonymously. Using, for example, computers to do the questioning so that the patient is not embarrassed by having to tell an interviewer that they do this, that, or the other. And that's called computer-assisted interviewing. And it really tremendously increases the willingness of patients to tell you about some of the exotic things they do. And these technologies are not being used routinely, and most of the surveys done in Africa, and indeed in this country, do not spend the time and energy to gain the trust of the patients and the time it takes to get valid answers.
Well, I mean, I can imagine in a setting where you, you know, white epidemiologists from Colorado are interviewing, you know, black women in the city. Why should they, and you're sitting there with your white coat and your pen and your clipboard, you know, why should they trust you? How do you get past that?
Well, I've been doing that for 37 years, talking to people about the most intimate secrets of their lives. I'm 62, and I've been talking to people that were, you know, a third of my age for many, many years, you know, teenagers and people of all ethnic backgrounds, and have had relatively little difficulty getting them to open up to me. Part of it is my expertise, part of it is my personality. People feel comfortable telling me things. But the other thing is, I think that if you do the right things and say the right things, and they trust you, people are just very voluble. They'll tell you all kinds of stuff. And I've never found that paint job was a problem between people, meaning that, you know, say a black person or a white person, that makes any difference at all. I think people relate to people. And if they feel you're a good person and you're trustworthy and you have a legitimate motive, they'll tell you anything you want to know.
We're talking to epidemiologist John Potterat. Let's go back for a moment to Africa. One factor that you've talked about in all of the question of AIDS in Africa is the effect of colonialism in Africa on people's desire to get their medicine through injections as opposed to through, you know, pills or other means. Tell us about this.
Yeah, there's this whole myth that injections are magic and that they work better than other means of therapy, so that both the patient and the doctors are highly motivated to receive shots. The patient thinks that if they receive a shot, that it's going to be more effective, and the provider, the person providing the shot, gets more money. They get like 30 cents for an injection, but they get only 2 cents for, say, a pill. So there is an incentive on the part of the provider to provide shots and an incentive on the part of the patient to receive them. I'm going to tell you something that's going to put you on your butt, which is a report that came out in the press today from France, Agence France-Presse, where they said that in India, two-thirds of the injections that are administered in India are unsafe. Two-thirds. And that amounts to, most in India, there's 3 to 6 billion, I said billion, not million, injections administered in the country every year, with about 2 to 4 billion being unsafe. Now that's staggering. And that's just out of India. And, you know, that's because they did some sort of a study. I'll bet you in Africa the situation is not terribly different. And what perplexes me is, why aren't people looking at that?
Well, let's turn that back to you. Why aren't people looking at that?
Well, I think there are two things that make it difficult. One of them is that if somehow the emphasis, they're afraid that if we begin to de-emphasize sex, people will then not use sexual self-defense, which is a silly consideration because, you know, there's enough being transmitted by sex in Africa. About a third of the cases is 10 million cases. That I think we should tell Africans, look, you need to keep your sexual guard up. You're doing a good job. Keep it up. But we also need to educate the public in Africa to demand safe health care. I think safe health care will come when the African health consumer insists on having them show that they're going to use injections that are, one, necessary, and two, that are safe or that are clean, sterilized. Why would people in the STD-HIV industry be reluctant to admit that? It's because it's much easier to get funding and attention for a sexually transmitted disease than it is for needle disease. And perhaps there is, and I'm just speculating, perhaps there's a fear that funding streams will be curtailed if all of a sudden it's shown that by using safe medical care, the epidemic could implode, and it probably would. And so I think there is also the weight of tradition. And you know what's amazing about AIDS in Africa is that when they came to that conclusion, it was based on very flimsy evidence.
The conclusion about?
That it was heterosexually transmitted. They just said, gee, it looks like it's sexually transmitted, therefore it is. And they simply asserted it. If you go back to the literature just prior to the consensus, which was in 1988, and you look at it, not only did it go against what little evidence that there was, which was that about half of it was transmitted through medical care at the time, but they just simply asserted that it was sexually transmitted, I think because politically and ideologically they needed to have one place that they could point to and say, see, it's heterosexually transmitted. So in this country it started with gay men or injecting drug users, but, you know, we're next, we being the heterosexuals. And so I think part of it was wishful thinking. They were so desperate to find a place where heterosexual transmission would sustain HIV that they just went ahead and simply asserted that that's what was going on, when in point of fact, that was not the case. And even the evidence at the time pointed that there was as much variance explained by contaminated medical care as there was by sex.
And the politics, I guess, did seem to work. In other words,
And you know, putting myself in their shoes, I can't blame them, because, you know, until people said it was heterosexually transmitted, and this is largely a myth, by the way, until that was said and asserted, very few people paid very much attention to this disease. The Reagan administration ignored HIV until April of 1987, when I think it was the first time Reagan said anything about HIV infection. And before that, because it was a disease of men that had sex with men, and injecting drug users, they felt these were marginal people anyway. Why worry about it? But the moment you said that it could be transmitted between quote-unquote real people, meaning heterosexuals, then all of a sudden attention and funding streams accompanied that assertion. So why get rid of a cash cow and all that attention? And I think part of the fear today, it's not just that people will drop their guard sexually, and they shouldn't, but also that funding streams will be curtailed.
The time is coming up to 8:32 on KSFR, and we're talking to epidemiologist John Potterat. What would happen if people started to think of AIDS and HIV as not primarily sexually transmitted diseases, but really took into account other factors? I mean, I guess the fear is that people would stop protecting themselves altogether.
Well, that would be a stupid mistake on their parts, because that would be equating HIV with the only STD that's worth worrying about. There's about 30 flavors of STD out there, and so there's plenty of them out there that can do some damage to your body, and about half a dozen of which can do some serious damage, from triggering cancer to, you know, threatening your life as well as your fertility. So that because there are incurable STD out there other than HIV, and because if you're sexually adventurous, you can be exposed to them in penis-to-vagina fashion, my feeling is that dropping your sexual guard is foolishness. Even if I could give you a vaccine tomorrow for HIV infection, guarantee that you wouldn't get HIV, you'd still have to use safer sex because of the other junk out there, and there's a lot of it.
Now, you talked about in some detail about the question of unsafe needles in Africa, and of course, HIV drug use is a very strong way of transmitting HIV in the United States. What about unsafe needles in healthcare settings? Is that a problem here in the United States?
You know, we don't know that because we're not asking the question. I would imagine that it probably isn't under most circumstances, meaning 98%. But you know, there are pockets of third world conditions in the United States. There are neighborhoods where recent immigration groups have imported their traditional healing practices as well, so that you may have pockets of, say, in Korean neighborhoods or Pakistani neighborhoods or Hmong neighborhoods or something, where parallel to the traditional medical system here, which is, you know, which pays attention to sterilization, they may be administering needle-type procedures, either for acupuncture or for tattooing or some ritualistic or medical or dental reasons, and not use sterile techniques. So there are parts, for example, of Florida that's very much like third world healthcare types of conditions and settings. The point is, we don't really know because we're not asking the questions, and we're not doing outbreak investigation. To get back to the African American women for a moment, I just think it's something that should be investigated and laid to rest one way or the other, because I cannot explain why there is a furious rate of infection among them. They don't really deserve it, do they? According to the sexual histories that we get from these women, it just doesn't make sense.
Let's turn for a moment to acupuncture. It seems highly unlikely that AIDS would be spread through acupuncture, since the vast majority of acupuncturists use disposable needles, and B, the AIDS virus is extremely fragile, and if it were to, you know, even to get onto a needle, it wouldn't last more than a half a minute, would it?
Well, I think you're probably mostly right about A, but I don't think you're right about B. I think that acupuncture is not likely to be involved in any sort of serious transmission of anything. I will agree with you. It's just that we need to explore everything. That's the reason I mentioned acupuncture, because it's something that pricks your skin. But I agree with you. I think it's not likely. But the HIV bug is extremely robust and hardy and can survive for several days, sometimes weeks, at room temperature in instruments. I mean, that's been demonstrated. I think the last report I saw there was... they showed that even after 3 or 4 weeks, it was still viable. I don't know whether it retained its pathogenicity, its ability to cause disease, but the point is, I think it's more robust than, say, gonorrhea or syphilis, which would die very quickly.
You spoke a few minutes ago about the situation in India, where billions of injections per year are unsafe. What do you mean specifically by unsafe?
Meaning that they either reuse the same needle without sterilizing it, or they reuse the syringe. They change the needle, maybe, but they keep the syringe, and so there would be some contaminated fluid in the syringe so that even if you put a fresh needle in there, you could have transmission occur that way. And also, the faulty practices might be involved. I didn't read the detail on how they did the study in India as to how they classified 63% of their injections as being unsafe, including 74% of the injections provided under immunization circumstances, which shocked me. I mean, usually immunizations are much safer than medical injections. So I don't really know the detail, not having read the report. It's just that it was just released today in France.
It's quite shocking that the very place you go to get healthy, whether it be in South Africa in a rural health care clinic or India or anywhere, is potentially the cause of your illness.
Well, you know, the Hindus say that the central fact of life is suffering. I think its coding is irony. I think you just pointed to an important irony. You know, and we see that pattern, and we don't know if that's a fact or not. We see the pattern. There has been an explosion of health delivery in Africa, in some parts of South Africa, particularly South Africa, where they've tried to deliver with barefoot doctors or things, or persons like that, of care to the rural areas that were underserved. And you know something? If you look at the temporal association, the time association between expanding healthcare in the countryside and the rise in HIV infection, they parallel each other. Now, I know that this is an association. We don't know if one is causing the other, but I think it's awfully intriguing that as you increase the delivery of medical care to people, you have a parallel increase in the HIV burden. I think it's something that needs to be seriously investigated.
And as so far it has not?
I don't think so, no.
We're talking to epidemiologist John Potterat. Now, you were there, you were an established working epidemiologist at the beginning of the AIDS outbreak in the early 1980s in this country. How has your way of looking at the disease changed over the last 20 years?
It really hasn't changed very much. I mean, what's remarkable about this infection is that within the first 18 months of the virus being identified in, I think it was March of 1981, within the first 18 months, epidemiologists figured out its major modes of transmission, both sexually and through contaminated needles. And I don't think much has changed. I think what's changed is the politics and the ideology and, you know, this kind of stuff. But I think what's been most remarkable about HIV infection is its stubborn conservatism. It just has not left the groups that were initially identified as being at highest risk, meaning men that have sex with men, people that do receptive anal intercourse, or contaminated injection equipment or contaminated needles. And there has been no place in the world that has demonstrated that heterosexual transmission sustains the epidemic. No place. I don't care what you've heard, it's not true. No place where there's been a scientifically valid, properly controlled set of conditions where you can, without question, show that heterosexual transmission, meaning penis to vagina, is sustaining HIV transmission. It just hasn't been done.
So in other words, what that means is if that were the only way that HIV were transmitted, it would not survive as a disease.
You conclude correctly. Yes. In other words, on a population level, it would die out.
Very interesting. What do you think are the most effective means of stopping the spread of HIV and AIDS, both in the United States and the rest of the world?
Because it depends on the locale and what the major modes of transmission are. But I think staying away from high-risk sexual practices, or at least unprotected high-risk practices, principally anal intercourse. Unprotected anal intercourse is the most dangerous. Also being very selective about your sexual partners and confining them to as few as you can possibly get away with. meaning being sexually adventurous, you need to be very conservative and you need to be very responsible. And then paying attention to safe injection practices, whether you're an injecting drug user or you work in a medical setting. And I think that if you could get people never to have unsafe anal sex, never, and never to use a contaminated needle, I think this disease would go away.
We're talking to John Potterat. The types of studies that you have been talking about that you feel should be done in Africa and other parts of the world, are they starting to be done? Is this way of thinking about AIDS and HIV having an influence?
Yeah, we published a whole series of papers, I think close to 30 or something, in the last couple of years. And some folks have been paying attention because we're beginning to get intimations from the field, from Pakistan, from India, from South Africa, from East Africa, that people are beginning to pay attention to safer medical practices. For example, you know that President Bush has agreed to send $15 billion to help with AIDS in Africa. Well, Senator Sessions, who's a Republican from Alabama, Senator Sessions was able, because of our work, to go ahead and attach a rider where a certain amount of those $15 billion, I can't remember how many hundreds of millions of dollars it was, would be devoted to assuring safer medical care, injection practices, and those kinds of things. So there are changes being made, and there are studies that are looking now at the exposure that Africans have to contaminated needles, at least in needles, and then trying to do the studies. These things take time. There's a long gestation period.
It seems that the fix wouldn't necessarily be all that difficult. In other words, a bunch of education and a bunch of Clorox bleach.
You're correct. And I think sometimes the logistics, particularly in the rural areas of poor countries like, you know, Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa, the logistics can be daunting. You're talking about people who don't have electricity, who don't have refrigeration, who may not have hot water. Where living is like living in an unmade bed. It's very difficult to even do the things that you propose, which are fairly basic. So never underestimate the inability of some people to be able to assure safety, because the easiest technological changes or practices are sometimes very difficult in reality to implement.
What would be an example of that?
Well, for example, if you wanted to sterilize needles or something like that, you'd need hot water or an autoclave or something like that, and that requires electricity. And if you don't have a generator, or if the electricity is not working, or if the rebels that are fighting, you know, in your village or cut you off or something, then you have the choice of either administering a shot to a person who's going to die unless you give them the shot, with a needle that you're not sure is safe. I mean, that's the reality for many people that are dirt poor, is that even the simplest things may be very, very difficult. Remember that in Africa, I think the average allocation for the entire health budget, all of it, is $1 per person per year. I mean, that's not a hell of a lot of resources being available. So they need an infrastructure as well. And I think, you know, epidemiology is a science of the possible. And we ought to take those steps to do as much as we can now, but it's not going to go away for several years, if not a decade or more, until you can go anywhere in the world and receive a safe injection.
But at least the consciousness that is a major part of the problem has to make its way into people's minds.
And I think, at least in some circles, this is beginning to penetrate. And, you know, my interest is in making sure that the average man on the street, as it were, in Malaysia, in Pakistan, in India, in South Africa, know what you know. And that is to say that it's not just sex, but it's also needles, so that once the consumer is aware, then that's where the activism begins. The consumer will simply insist that I want to make sure that you guys, you know, give me a clean shot, that kind of stuff. And until the consumer insists on it, it's not likely that the bureaucrats are going to move very fast. One, because there's generally insufficient funding, and two, because bureaucrats tend to be, they move like molasses, very slowly.
And probably to some extent, it's hard for them to shift beliefs about this. I mean, for me, looking at this, it's like, it's a big shift to realize that HIV is primarily transmitted ways in places.
You don't have to buy into the Gisselquist-Potterat hypothesis that indeed this is what's happening. I think you owe people safe medical care so that even if you don't believe that HIV is driven by contaminated health care, so long as you admit that it may be a lot of it, say 10, 20, 30% or whatever, don't you think that's sufficient to provoke changes to assure that there is safe health care? I mean, do you have to wait till there's a certain percentage, 70%, 20%, 5%, before you do that? No, I think in this country it would be unacceptable if even 1% of the injections were contaminated. Why do we put up with it in Africa being 5, 10, or 20, or 50%? One of the ironies that just makes me upset is to see that when UNAIDS sends its people to Africa, they give them a booklet where they discourage them from using medical care in Africa, saying that the needles may be contaminated. So they warn their people, their staff, but they don't warn the Africans. So why is it that it's not good for their staff to have medical care in African hospitals or clinics, but somehow they don't go on the radio and tell Africans, look, we don't think it's safe for our people, and we don't think, therefore, it's safe for you. They don't do that.
And
I think that's really, that bothers me.
And what's that about? I mean, it's a condescending attitude, or?
I don't know. I don't know what the UNAIDS mind is like, or, you know, how they set policy. I can just point out to you that there is a document that they give to people that says, don't use the care, or be careful, but they don't do the same thing to the Africans that live in that country. And I don't know if that, you know, what's involved behind that. I just know that the first thing that pops into my mind is double standards, and that's not all that good.
Well, John Potterat, we're coming to the end of our time together. I want to thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. We've been speaking with John Potterat, who has been an epidemiologist for the last 37 years. He was the director of the STD-AIDS program at the El Paso County Health Department, Department of Health and the Environment in Colorado, and has received numerous awards, written numerous articles on the subject of STD and AIDS, and we're delighted to have you with us on KSFR.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.